This is the News and Talk of Nevada. Now, Bosma on Business with award-winning entrepreneur Mike Bosma. We're getting Northern Nevada back to business on News Talk 780 KOH. And I've been taking care of business every day. Taking care of business every way. I've been taking care of business. It's all mine. Taking care of business and working overtime. We're out.
Good morning, Reno. It is Mike Bosma, your business savvy CPA, in the throes of busy season. Yes, you business owners out there know exactly what I'm talking about. Scrambling, getting your work and trial balances to your account so they can get your tax return. It's generally due on March 15th. And most people like to extend those things. So just saying, let's file a form 7004. Extend away. No cost to extend, but you do need to pay your tax. Of course, each and every week on Bosma on Business, we give you 60 minutes of business awesome. This week, no different. Going to get a little bit into the building industry. Chris Yount from Fortifiber fame in studio. Chris, welcome to Bosma on Business.
Thanks for having me, Mike.
My pleasure. And who's going to pay for it all? The financier extraordinaire, Andy Backstrom from Egg of the West. Andy, welcome.
Thank you, Mike, as always.
So, Chris, you know, we start our little ditty off with a little... let's call it elevator pitch. Tell us all about your business.
Well, Fortifiber is a building products manufacturing company here in Northern Nevada. We manufacture waterproofing products for home construction.
Waterproofing products. Well, I'll tell you, the weather is just right for the. I'm sure you're in high demand right now.
It's great business for us. Pennies from heaven.
Right. Droplets.
Yes.
What is all this condensation from above? It's crazy.
Helps people realize that they need to build houses right, and that's where we come in.
Okay. And how'd you get into the business?
So I'm a third-generation owner and manager of the company. My grandfather founded it in 1939, so we're our 78th year in business here.
Oh, congratulations. That's awesome. And where did business start?
We started in Los Angeles area, where my grandfather was from, and about 25 years ago, like so many other business owners, California was no longer a place that made a lot of sense for us to do business. Taxation, regulation, just very difficult environment. And Nevada is a very business-friendly environment. We moved to Fernley in 1993, and it's been a great manufacturing center for us ever since.
All right. And how many folks do you have employed for you?
75.
75, and they're all in Fernley?
We have about 13 or 14 salespeople scattered around the country. We sell nationwide, so those folks live in their local markets. But on the manufacturing side, the rest are all here.
Lucky. Yeah. So, Now, 75 is, I know the construction industry has been a bit of a roller coaster.
It has. 2008 was a brutal one. About 80% of housing starts in this country disappeared in about a year.
So if you sell waterproofing material for the housing industry, you're just building inventory at this juncture? What do you do?
Well, we went through the tough stuff that everybody goes through in a downturn like that. We had to close some plants. We had a few manufacturing facilities around the country, layoffs, wage freezes, and all the horrible things you hate to have to do. But we came through the other side stronger for it.
Okay. That's just, some of those hard times where you just have to batten down the hatches and keep the boat afloat.
They're tough lessons, but glad that I went through them. It was the best business education I could have asked for.
Right.
One I would never want to get again.
Right. But. Yeah. Nobody wants to go back to school if you can help it, right?
No.
I got you. So at its peak, how many employees did you have?
Our highest point would have been maybe 350. We had a few other manufacturing facilities at the time.
So shut those down and kind of consolidated back to the Fernley headquarters.
Sure. And we also changed a bit on how we deliver products.
Okay.
Sourcing from other companies, partnering with other companies to get things manufactured. We really changed our attitudes about some of the ways we deliver products and get the most world-class technologies.
Okay.
If it doesn't fit on our equipment, we'll find somebody who has the ability to make something that's the best for our customers.
Okay. Gotcha. And who do you sell through?
We sell through essentially professional versions of Home Depot, where major home builders would go buy, lumber yards and dealers, Whitecap, DHC Supply are two major ones that are here in this market. But it depends on the company across the country.
Okay, and if we were going just to kind of get in our listeners' minds, kind of we talk about waterproofing, so So what exactly, where does your product enter into a house?
The bulk of our products are in the wall. So we're behind the stucco or the siding. You'll see a black paper or a plastic house wrap. We make both those types of products, tapes that seal up the window, caulkings. We also do some waterproofing underneath the concrete slab, keeping moisture from bubbling up through the ground as it might on a rainy day such as this.
Okay.
As well as some products that go underneath your hardwood flooring and keep too much moisture from coming up and bending and buckling your hardwood floors.
Gotcha. And then any kind of toxins or anything in those, was your, in the manufacturing process that you got to be aware of?
For our product line, they're very benign. The only products with VOCs, volatile organic compounds, which is an indoor air pollutant that people should be aware of. Mm-hmm. A lot of sealants and caulkings will have those, kind of off-gas products that you don't really want to be breathing.
Right.
Our sealant is as close to zero VOCs as you can get.
So
we try to stay on the green side of things.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Cool. So 75 folks kind of sell through the private industry. And how's business going now?
So it's going great. You know, housing starts are the lifeblood of our company.
Right.
And they've been on a great tear since about 2009, 2010. Another 4 or 5% growth last year in housing starts. And we're getting more than our share of that. New products, getting into expanding into markets where we weren't stronger.
Right.
The Northeast, the Upper Midwest were generally historically weak markets for us, and we've grown a lot in those areas.
Okay.
In the past. They've found their waterproofing practices, especially in the Upper Northeast, were pretty poor when it came to stucco and some other things that
More
traditional in the West, where we have some real expertise, and some of our products are best in class.
So, so that creates opportunity for you. No, and it's one of those things you learn about different people's journeys and, you know, through the ebbs and flows of business, you're like, okay, how do you riddle the business? And so, now do you, any international or all just U.S.?
A little bit into Canada and Mexico. And we do a few one-off, exports from time to time. An architect firm here in the U.S. will specify a building in Dubai or something like this,
right.
and they'll come over and take a container completely specified of 100% American products, but not ongoing in a major way. That we've done some exploring in a few other countries recently to diversify the business. I was on a trade mission this last year in Japan.
Oh, fun!
Working with builders and architects over there to help understand their needs and how our products might fit in there as well.
Yeah, I was going to say, usually, you know, the made in USA, especially when it comes to waterproofing, right? there's high quality versus low cost, low quality. It seemed like if people wanted to stay dry, they're going to want to make sure that they've got the best.
It's a major issue in our industry. A few years ago, a group tried to bring in, we make an asphalt saturated craft paper. It's black paper that you see underneath stucco. And a group from China tried to bring in a similar looking, but made out of coal tar instead of asphalt product. And coal tar is a type 1 carcinogen. This is gamma radiation, asbestos, cigarette smoke,
right.
category of cancer causing. And it's banned in most products in the U.S. And they tried to bring it into the U.S. when we helped the industry understand. You get what you pay for when you bring in some of these.
This is a bad actor right now, right?
Yeah, and the reliability, warranty, support of a company that's going to be here if there's a problem. We think all those things are pretty important to be made in the U.S.
Okay. No, and that's where, on the intellectual property part of the equation, Chris, what patents, trademarks do you have? Do you know, make sure?
We have a lot of trademarks going back with a long history like ours. We've got trademarks that'll go back 60, 70 years. Patents, we tend to take more of the philosophy of the way we build our products are somewhat proprietary and secret to us. If you put it in a patent, you have to tell the world how you did the magic trick.
And that's just true.
So a lot of things, we have unique processes in our equipment my grandfather invented, and we still don't talk about and still are not well understood by our
competitors. Well, tell our listeners, what is that exactly, Chris?
Probably a bit too technical for the listener.
Okay. So, because, that's where, the ability to apply some kind of sticky stuff to plastic and do it consistently, because water is just going to look for the path of least resistance to get through.
Consistency in manufacturing is the name of the game. When you're having a machine spit out 500 feet a minute of a product, quality control at those types of speeds is very difficult, and doing it right it takes a lot of practice and know-how.
Right.
And so we work really hard with our engineering team, and our we have some great long-term people who've been working these machines for decades and in many cases generations. I'm the first third generation of our company, but we've had other third generation employees who have worked in our business.
Wow. So that have been around that long. Okay,
that
cool.
Have a lot of information and understanding on how to do these types of things right.
Okay. So of course, business advisor extraordinaire, Andy Backstrom, you know, Andy, one of the things I've always appreciated about you is, you know, with kind of a finance economics background, you kind of understand the macro climate of what's going on, and where do you see the construction industry? What's percolating out there?
Well, it's getting strong again. That they have capital available.
I was going to say, so are banks lending for these types of things
definitely,
again?
Definitely. Okay. Like you referenced 08, 09, and we really felt the weakness more in 10, 11, 12 mm-hmm. in banking by the time it trickled down, so it dried up. Of course, spec type building and raw land really went away
right.
for all intents and purposes, but that's even coming back. So, yeah, it's fairly strong. Banks are back to competing with one another, and I think your listeners would probably have two or three options now if they're a you know, well-run business, been around a while. Yeah, they should have multiple options with banks competing, which is good for everyone.
So competition is good, right? So it's always got a couple of people, which is, I've always said on this show, you want to keep a couple of relationships with banks just so that as you need growth capital, you've got different options, because the reality is banks toggle on or toggle off of sectors even. Which is amazing to me is like, there's no surprise that the housing sector got completely battered and beat up back in 2008, 2010. And if you were in it in a big way, you were going to, there's no way you were going to come out of that unscathed. But the, it's funny as lenders, and they're still paranoid about the financing base. Are people going to, or do we have a bubble? So, I guess Andy, I just have to ask a question. So right now housing average price is, the data was just released this last week, 26 most expensive place to live, in Reno. Now, Chris, you sell your product nationwide, but just in the local market, Andy, do you see any cause for concern for how housing prices are trending?
Boy, that's a tough one to predict, but right now I would say no, with the demand for housing
right.
and all the new starts. I mean, capital's flowing in. Some pretty smart people are taking big positions on multifamily. They look at the metrics really hard before they do that. I'm probably getting a call once a week for multifamily, meaning condo or apartment mm-hmm. type projects. So, rates are staying nice and low. Still, right. They've ticked up a little,
relatively
speaking, very low. Mm-hmm. Doesn't seem to be enough supply. If you look at EDON's projections right. for
We need more houses. We need more waterproof moisture barrier. So let's do this when we come back. Let's talk about kind of how you grow that business, how you build that your manufacturing plant back up in the rebuild. It's Reno 2.0 on Bosma on Business. News Talk 780 KOH. Welcome back to Bosma on Business. Your host, Mike Bosma, in studio talking about getting manufacturing ramped back up in Reno, in this iteration. Friendly, we talk about the Reno corridor. I was at a breakfast meeting last week that Lance Gilman spoke at. Of course, Lance, colorful guy, Chris.
Yes, he is.
Colorful guy. And he said he's going to be on the show, so stay tuned. Not only owning a brothel, but also, being the driving force behind the Tahoe Reno Industrial Center. And, talk about, the kind of the Reno community of business, the kind of the 50 miles around Reno and about 900,000 people, that is served in that 50 mile radius. And it's a lot bigger than Reno, And so, Chris, you're in Fernley, and
yep.
Andy Backstrom from Bank of the West fame, as we're talking about kind of getting the construction industry going back again, touch a little bit on multifamily. So you mentioned it before the break. So as big, sophisticated investors look at multifamily and affordability. You know, what does that mean to Northern Nevada? How are those types of businesses impacting the ability to kind of create affordability and a footprint here?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They're looking at the price, you know, the square footage, right. Price per square foot, and the rents, and rents are going up. The vacancies, I think the real thing that's impacting positively is vacancies gone right. so far down.
Right. Yeah.
And they look at that. Right now we're seeing the one negative is the values are so, or the cost to acquire
build, right.
those assets are so high that it doesn't mesh with the financing availability. Often I won't get, you know, everyone confused on debt service coverage and all of that, but we basically take the net operating income over the proposed debt service, and you want to reach a 1.2 or so, and that's pretty uniform, 1.25 across the banks. But the price on those assets, if you say put your standard 30% down, the math isn't working on the banking side.
Right.
I mean, but missing by a long shot.
Right.
So
because it's so expensive to build or to buy or both.
Both
okay.
right now. Yeah, and it's just such a hot asset in this valley.
So what that means is you got to put more down in order to get your debt service.
Yes, yes. So we're seeing borrowers and buyers with more capacity to bring in a larger down
right.
payment. That is not the case for industrial, owner-occupied, retail, office,
okay.
still
yeah.
kind of the same loan-to-value parameters we've always seen. But, yeah, in multifamily, it seems like to make the math work from the banking side, you got to have more capacity coming in a larger down
right.
for now. That
okay.
that
right.
will reverse like everything, you know, ebb and flow.
Right.
But right now, that's a real hot asset, almost too hot for the banking industry. Well,
you know, the banks, like I said, they got their fingers burned on the stove a number of years ago, so they're tentative. Let's put it that way. So Chris Yount, CEO of Fortifiber, you know, 75 folks out in the Fernley plant. You know, how have you guys been able to kind of scale into multifamily and take advantage of that growth?
Well, we've seen since the downturn so many folks couldn't afford a single family house anymore, and so multifamily was really the sector that came back first, way faster than single family housing did. And there's a lot of demographics behind that switch. Besides affordability, there's the millennials coming up and they're young adults just starting out in life, trying to get out of mom and dad's basement. And an apartment or a condo is a lot more affordable way to do that.
Right.
As well as people who were damaged in the downturn whose credit scores were such that they weren't going to go out and buy a single family
right.
house. So
right.
multifamily's been the bright spot for the last 5 or 6 years in the housing start story. And so what we've done is we've switched. Many of our products work in both environments, both a traditional site-built single-family house as well as multifamily. And we've switched to speaking more to the architects, builders, right. and groups that are building right. these developments to make sure that we're putting together the right package for their needs. And that's been a huge savior for the business.
Well, and that's where in your business model, Chris, I think a lot of times people don't understand that when they say you want an architect to spec, you know, you specifically. So, and that's where when you have your drawings done up by your architect, that there, you know, a lot of times they'll say, well, you know, you need 2x4, you don't spec lumber specifically, you just need lumber. But and just out of curiosity, 2x4s, they're not 2x4.
They're 1.5 by 3.5.
So
that's an unfortunate trend in the building products industry is people tend to cheat and cheat and cheat and get a little bit less and less every year. And we find it in our space where the products that are supposed to be of a certain weight get
right.
a little bit lower and lower every year. And for some reason, some people tolerate it. We go after the types of people who want things to be truly what they say they are.
Okay. I was just going to say 2x4. It's not 2x4. It's 1.5 by 3.5.
Yeah.
But just the stuff that drives me crazy.
Me too.
You know, one of the things, so we're looking at, you know, multifamily, like, hey, but if you can get the architect to say you need mine, like if you're going to do a certain type of stucco, for example, he's like, well, hey, we know that we work really well with this type of stucco, and you get the architect to spec you, you don't have to worry about getting, you know, getting price shopped for that, right?
Exactly. So we work, our salespeople work very hard to spend time with architects, and that's a grueling process to go through. These are well-educated, very bright people who come through and they'll evaluate, and they're seeing every one of our myriad competitors come through the door and explain why they're the best, and we have to make our case and help them understand how our quality, warranty, support, service right. are going to be superior for their project, and we have to win that bid.
Right, and it's one of those things you never want to ever get to the point of actually having to warranty anything.
Well, that's a point of differentiation we've taken in our industry. So about a decade ago, we launched the first real warranty in our industry, okay. our section of the industry, and we've increased it. Actually, we're a 15-year total labor and material warranty. So we're much more comprehensive than the competition. And the reason we do that is, one, we're a family-owned and operated business, so we're more comfortable with the risks of putting our name on it than say, a Wall Street-traded type company.
Okay.
And two, we've been doing it a long time, and our quality control is such that we believe in the products, and right. so we stand behind them. And that's a cultural difference. That's an approach to business right. difference that we take, but we think it's one of our secret weapons.
Yeah, well, and that's where it's interesting, of course, the accountant in me, of course, I'm thinking how the warranty reserve you have to book on your financial statements. How do you calculate, you know, because no matter how good your products are, you're going to have some that fail. So that's just the nature of the beast. So how do you figure out what you're going to have to pay out in warranty?
Our warranty claims are very low, relatively speaking, to sales. And actually, for the most part, we try to work with a homeowner if there is a problem.
Right.
We come out and we try to work with them before there's any major issues or
okay.
concerns.
Right.
And that's, one, much more cost effective, and two, usually we find we've made a sale for life, because when we're working with that builder to deal with the leak, well over 9 times out of 10, there's an installation error. The
right.
product was put in backwards, or an adjacent material was put in wrong.
Right.
And we help them understand where they made errors, how they can correct their process going forward. And then that builder is thankful for
right.
for the help we provided, the consulting for free, and they want to work with us for the rest of their lives.
Cool.
So I see the warranty as being a sales tool, not a liability.
Yeah, it's interesting. I had some problem on the carpet in my building, and the carpet had like forever long warranty on it. So of course, same thing. The carpet rep comes out, and he's like, "Well, they're supposed to glue the seams. They didn't glue the seams. That's why it's pulling up. You know, so it's an installation error." And of course, my flaky installer, bless his heart, grr. Yeah, so let's do this when we come back. You're talking about growing a business in Fernley, Nevada, kind of construction, and mostly manufacturing. So how to grow a manufacturing business. Andy Backstrom from Bank of the West, Chris Yant from Fortifiber. It's Bosma on Business. News Talk 780 KOH. Welcome back to Bosma on Business. Your host, Mike Bosma, talking about manufacturing in the great state of Nevada. In studio, Chris Yant from Fortifiber and Andy Backstrom from Bank of the West. You know, one of the things that most of our listeners, if I had a venture guest, just would not know, and is that if as much as we try and say we are business friendly to manufacturers, it's actually a fairly high hurdle to get over to qualify for some of the incentives that the great state of Nevada has out there for you. And the rules are opaque, let's put them that way. So if you were to go to the Economic Development Authority of Western Nevada, for example, to their website, or Governor's Office of Economic Development, GOED, and look at the criteria, you're going to say, wow, depending on kind of where your business is, you're going to need a certain amount of jobs, have to pay a certain amount, and have a certain amount of capital equipment that you're going to have to buy in order to get these abatements. And the problem is there's a lot of capital that goes into these projects. And especially when you talk about, Chris, when you moved up, I think in 93, you said 25 years ago, that was, what most people don't appreciate is how the cost, the disruptive cost to pull all the employees, all the equipment and retool that up here, and what that real out of pocket cost is. And so that, and it's, those are hard, you're going to get that paid back over a series of years, and all our abatement package, really all it is we're not going to make you pay tax on it. And that's prospective. And so you're like, it's a big capital hit. When you guys decided to move up here, I mean, how did you guys toggle that transition?
We, that was the only time we've qualified for, a state of Nevada benefit where we had a industrial revenue bond, which was essentially a very affordable loan to help us finance the new building. It was built completely from scratch, and to move, we were moving three manufacturing facilities into one, kind of creating a super Western manufacturing facility was the plan. And so we had a 25-year industrial revenue bond that was at a great interest rate. That was very helpful in getting us to come out here. We've worked with the EDON folks, as you mentioned, on other pieces of equipment we've brought in, but we've had a hard time finding programs that we fit, that we're creating enough jobs at once. When we add a piece of equipment, we might add three or four jobs at a time, and they're looking more for the 10 or 12. And those are pretty major investments for our type of business.
Right. Yeah, and that's a lot of times there's the way that business works is it's very, I guess, let's call it sophisticated. You buy big capital equipment, but you don't need a lot of people to run it. That's why you buy the equipment.
Exactly. Try to be more efficient every day.
And you know, and so that's where I see a lot of, you know, from a planning perspective, Chris, I see a lot of leasing companies. We set up, you know, almost, there's almost like, not cookie cutter, but I'd say a fairly prototypical approach where you say, well, gosh, if we're not going to get any incentives, you know, we can finance what amounts to finance a sales tax on this stuff by doing our own internal leasing company. The other thing you mentioned, you know, with your sales force out on, you know, 13 folks spread throughout the United States. You know, the states have a fascinating perspective on Nexus, in California being primary among them. In California changed their laws a handful of years ago that just said, hey, we don't care if you even trip into our state. If you just send stuff in, you've got Nexus, patently unconstitutional. I just facially just, hey, you know, you have to have, under the Quill standard, Supreme Court standard, you have to have a physical presence, substantial physical presence. And they said, nah, you don't.
We've had that argument in different states regarding who paid for the trucking to move the product from Nevada to their state. If we paid for it, then technically we owned it, and therefore we had a store in their state when it was delivered at the loading dock of a customer, versus the customer arranging for the freight. And so Nexus is a problem for us, and it's one we fight in all 50 states trying to figure it out.
One of the things the one thing I love about working with small, closely held businesses is you know, if you're Google, you know, you're publicly traded, and so everything percolates up to a parent company that's traded on the stock market. But if you're closely held, and especially if you're multi-generational, you can kind of have different ownership between the various entities, and you can slice or dice that, and you can have different choices of entity that don't allow the states to combine your activities. And so a lot of times what we'll do is we'll set up a sales subsidiary, like, okay, we can, because when you're selling, you know, you have to bifurcate how much your manufacturing process is creating value versus what the sales process. And sales process is pretty routine when you kind of know that there's a couple percentage points of margin to a straight sales company. And we call it encapsulating, kind of isolating the Nexus exposure, because we know what's creating Nexus. It's the sales activities. And so, we kind of use the state's rules against them. So that's when I first started focusing on state and local taxation. In federal taxation is fascinating. It was substance over form. Federal taxation is like, you know, kind of a step transaction doctrine. We don't care what you do. We're going to look through it all and collapse it. State taxation is exactly the opposite. It's like, well, if you go through the right steps, it really doesn't matter where it's going. We're going to respect each of the independent steps. And I'm like, well, let's do that.
Makes a lot of sense. We use a lot of the leasing concepts as well. We have a sister company that technically owns the majority of our land and equipment, and we have internal leases between the two.
And so that's what, for the benefit of our listeners, kind of what you do is, so like, let's say you buy a piece of equipment for $100,000. The sales tax on that is, you know, $8,000. So you say, well, I'll lease that for, you know, a couple thousand dollars a month for a period of years, and then we'll have you'll decide if we want to lease it at the end of that period, or you can sell it to somebody else. So, and then a lot of times, by doing that, you not only finance the $8,000 of sales tax, when you resell that piece of equipment and buy a new piece of equipment, you actually save the money on the tax for that base, that depreciated base of equipment. So you just got to know your business and kind of bake that in. You know, Andy, when you were talking about these kind of multi-companies, you know, how does a bank approach that when you've got brother sister companies kind of doing, you know, leasing equipment to the manufacturer? How do you look at it? How do you decide if you're going to loan money to it or not?
Well, the simple of it is you're looking at the operating cash flow of the business,
right,
and that's kind of your baseline. And then, however, the funds are flowing back and forth between the entities, you kind of isolate that out, and you look at really the cash flow to the business. So if you have, obviously, the business, you're looking to the cash flow, but say the leasing company, right, as you just referenced, say ABC Equipment Leasing, they're leasing back, you would throw all the debt in the denominator and compare it to the cash flow of the business, and then you would add back the rent or lease expense between the two entities, right, to the numerator. But you're really looking, most banks are going to look to the operating cash flow of the business and not get tied up in analyzing all the different entities. They're all sister pocket to pocket is what we call it.
Right, pocket to pocket. Yeah, I call it the same thing, right? It's like you're going to take it out of one pocket, put the other pocket, still your pocket, still your pants, right? But you got to play the game. I had especially, you know, if you're in a business where potentially there's liability, you know, it's just unfortunately, you know, things happen, you know, from a business perspective, people get hurt, then you get sued, and you just have to be able to protect the assets, you know, both the intellectual property and the tangible assets. And there's ways to do that legally. But you got to plan for it on the front end. You know, we're talking about state taxation and a lot of times, you sell a little bit into a state and, you know, there's certain states that are just more aggressive than others. You know, New Jersey is probably one of the most aggressive states out there. Itty bitty little state, you know, Court Christie, what are you doing? I love your brother, but come on. But, you know, you're just like, you know, a little bit of state, you know, not a lot of sales too, but, you know, they're just obnoxious, you know? And so you're like, okay, well, you can end up spending more fees defending something than the tax. So, and they know that. So they're like, okay, we know if we just bark real loud, we're going to get a lot of money out of you. So you just got to be able to kind of have a structure to say, okay, well, there's not a lot of dollars at play. You know, you just keep the dollars at a minimum, you know? And the other thing is we, you know, kind of talk about the different tax structures. When you talk about selling internationally, you know, Andy and I were working on a deal for a company that it did a significant amount of exports. We set up this thing called an IC disk. And the one thing I love, if you have a business out there that you can possibly send anything overseas that's made in the United States, send it overseas, it is so stupidly tax advantaged. It's like the holy grail where you can convert, you know, ordinary income on that product to capital gains. So basically to 39.6% money, converted into 23.8% money. And once Donald Trump gets done repealing Obamacare, 15% money, it's even better. So, and it's just, and it's, you know, very low headache to set up. You just, you know, it's literally not quite, but almost a paper company where you just pay commissions to it and pay it back. And yeah, it's a great way to convert ordinary tax dollars to capital gains. And a lot of times, like a lot of businesses out there went through the downturn, they got like these big capital loss carryovers and like, the aura of, you know, tax planning. Must be busy season. I can't help myself. So, you know, when you look at growing, how is the prospects for growth out there, Chris? Is, you know, plenty of employees probably lined up at the door, get as many as you can hire.
Well, in Northern Nevada, it's going to keep getting more competitive,
right,
with Tesla and all the rest coming in. There's been a lot of growth. So we haven't seen it yet. The average tenure in our business is a little over a decade. So we have good, long-term, stable, right, people that we're lucky enough to have work with us. But for the future, I'm watching closely the local labor markets and concerned about what our availability is going to be because God bless Edon. They're doing a good enough job to bring a lot of work to the area, and I don't know that we have enough people to handle it.
Right. So have you started feeling any of the wage pressure upwards yet? Or
Not much as yet. We try to be, when we're having good years, be sharing the wealth with our people.
Okay, cool.
So we've been increasing each year wages. So hopefully we're keeping pace with the world out there at large.
No, that's great. Well, that's a lot of times just, you know, your people knowing that you want to share the love out there to the extent you can is, goes a long way, just from an employee morale perspective, knowing that, hey, we're all in this thing together.
It does.
So let's do this when we come back. Let's talk about the number one thing when you're growing your manufacturing company in Northern Nevada. It's Bosma on Business, News Talk 780 KOH. Welcome back to Bosma on Business. Your host, Mike Bosma. You know, your business tax returns mostly due on March 15th, so it's coming right around the corner. If you need some help, give me a holler, 786-4900. Still doing those free one-hour consultations. If you need to kick the tires on what you got going, one of the common things I see is people, when they're starting their business, don't really appreciate how important making those right accounting method elections are. And we're experts at it. So me and my partners at Clifton Larson Allen can help get those changed around so that you can be able to present the financial statements you need to the bank for generally accepted accounting principles and report the lower taxable amount to the government. It's completely legit, completely legal. In fact, you're kind of on the wrong side of the equation if you're not doing that. So two sets of books is completely okay. In studio, Andy Backstrom from Bank of the West. Two sets of books, okay, right?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, okay. Andy said it's okay. Good. Okay.
Definitely.
So we leave our listeners with the number one thing. If you're going to build a manufacturing plan or process, what's the number one takeaway, Andy?
Well, get financing, get a financing partner that understands your business. Right now, when we're talking equipment, expansion brings equipment. Banks love that. Micra, I would almost say they like it more than real estate, which has never made empirical sense to me. Real estate's better secured, but commercial banks do a lot better across, the banking industry with equipment expansion. Love it. And it's something tangible they can touch. I think it gives the banker a lot of satisfaction to see the equipment growing and sending product down the line. So as you're growing, again, just get a good financing plan in place. One example is get an equipment line of credit that automatically converts to a term loan facility, so you're not renegotiating every piece of equipment with the bank. So and size it up, go larger. Banks will go fairly large on those. If you need $1 million, size it up to $2 million. It's got usually a year to 18 months call on it with an automatic conversion to term loan once the equipment is acquired.
So that way you're not having to borrow the money at the front end. You can kind of start paying interest on it as you get the equipment and service.
Yeah, it's interest only for the drawdown period. Yeah, definitely. But it really avoids having to do separate. Say you do 40 pieces of new equipment. You don't want to do a separate note and financing on every one of those. Your controller would be full-time dealing with the bank.
Pushing paper. I got you. Good intel. Chris Yant, Fortifiber. What do you think? Number one takeaway, manufacturing business.
I only know how to build a business that's a long-term business. And so for us, with manufacturing, quality is the number one takeaway. If you're taking care of the customers, you're turning out a quality product focused on the types of processes you need to make sure that every single piece going out the door is the same and is done right, you'll be around for a long time. It's as simple as that.
Right. No, especially in your space, overseas, I've just heard horror stories, anything having to do with plastic that, just the lack of quality, lack of consistency, lack of quality controls. So that would be my thing is.
It's a huge problem.
Yeah. Make sure that, the QC process of your manufacturing plant is kind of what that business will rise or fall on. So know what that QC is and make sure there's enough money invested in it so that the first piece is the same as the last piece comes off. Next week, more business advisors, more business awesome. It's Bosma on Business, News Talk 780 KOH.